evening. I appreciate your coming tonight. The topic that I'll be talking about tonight are some comparative aspects of what would be called the Jewish criminal law as opposed to the American criminal law that we are familiar with. Let me start off by making two preliminary points. First, describing something as Jewish criminal law is somewhat of an anachronistic expression, because the modern dichotomy that we have in a secular system between that which is purely civil and that which is purely criminal is fundamentally an artificial distinction that Jewish law intrinsically does not recognize. For example, in modern American law, there's an obvious difference between a civil proceeding, where I'm simply suing you for money, and a criminal proceeding where the state is trying to prosecute me for a crime. So, for example, if I steal a car, there are theoretically two different proceedings that can be brought against me. There can be an action in either conversion for the value of the car or replevin to get the car back, which is on the civil side. And then, of course, there's the criminal prosecution for auto theft. In Jewish law, basically, since the source of all duties is religious, there really is no distinction between the criminal and the civil. And nevertheless, it is useful to talk about criminal versus civil, because there are certainly areas in the Torah that correspond to what we would regard as being penal in nature. This will become clear as I go along, I hope. A second preliminary point that needs to be kept in mind is that we will be approaching this from two different angles. One is a purely comparative angle, kind of set up two columns, the Jewish criminal procedure versus the secular criminal procedure, which is one way of initially studying the topic. But then I hope to be able to proceed into a more complicated question, and that is one which is known by legal scholars as a conflict of law issue, and that is, okay, the Jewish procedure is so-and-so, the secular procedure is so-and-so, but given the fact that we are Jews who live in a government which has that secular procedure, how does Jewish law regard the legitimacy of alternative systems that do not maintain the intrinsic standards of Jewish law? That's a much more complicated issue. It's one thing to say Jewish law is this, secular law is this, but it's a much more difficult issue to discuss as to, therefore, what legitimacy does Jewish law offer to systems that do not in itself comport with the requirements of Jewish law. Okay, but first, let me just start off with yet another halakha. As you may know, one of the most hated figures in the Jewish tradition is the figure that is known as the Moser. The Moser is the informer. This was a nefarious character who would constantly be informing on the whereabouts of the persons and property of Jews to the non-Jewish, typically anti-Semitic governments, resulting in Jews being imprisoned, resulting in forfeiture of property. And the Talmud itself remarks that a Jew who is a Moser on other Jews, a Jew who informs on other Jews and turns them into the Gentile authorities, is such a sinner, ein lo chelek li'olam haba, he does not have a share in the world to come. Maimonides rules that such a person is subject to summary execution, that if in fact if I am aware of this Moser, I can shoot him. And in fact the story goes that we do have evidence that as late as the 1920s, if not later, there were various Jews who were informers for the communist government, and there is some evidence that they were basically executed with the consent of the sages. Now, occasionally you hear the following arguments. Given the fact that halakha sharply condemns the Moser, it is by definition, therefore, the argument so sometimes goes, that a Jew is not allowed to participate in the criminal justice system at all, as either a policeman, as a judge, as a member of a jury, as a prosecutor. I guess the defense would pose less issues in terms of Moser. You also hear the argument made, and again, it's, I want to say up front that it's a spurious argument, but it'll take a little while to show why that is so, that even if there's something involving such as child abuse or the like, one cannot go to the authorities because that is moser, that is turning the fellow Jew into the Gentiles, which is condemned as ein lo chelek, as someone who does not have a share in the world to come. That indeed is a spurious argument, and you'll see why as we go through the various materials. The key to resolving this is to understand under what circumstances does halakha accord legitimacy to the actions of a secular government, because obviously the argument would be this: to the extent the Jewish law system regards the government as being empowered to do certain things, there is nothing wrong with my facilitating the government in the exercise of its legitimate prerogatives, and the prohibition of Mesira could only apply to the illegitimate actions of a government and not to the legitimate actions of a government. The key therefore becomes, what governmental action does halakha regard as legitimate, and what governmental action does halakha regard as illegitimate? Again, this will become clear as we come along. But let's first start with the simpler part of the problem, and that is to sketch out in brief what Jewish criminal procedure would be and how it would differ with modern criminal procedure. Jewish law has a number of crimes, so to speak, that are considered to be penal in nature. Some of them don't sound like crimes. For example, under the Chumash, eating non-kosher food is a crime. It is punishable as such. Indeed, there are many, many crimes in the Torah which carry the ultimate punishment of capital punishment. Murder is one. Adultery is another, whether it's consensual or rape. Desecration of the Shabbat, etc. Idol worship, idolatry, blasphemy, all of these carry capital crimes. Bestiality, male homosexuality is actually considered to be a capital crime. And if you open up the Chumash at random, you tend to see almost in every other verse at various sections of the Chumash, for this crime, mot yumatz, he shall surely be put to death. For this crime, mot yumatz. So the first impression you get by reading the Chumash is that the Jewish Bible is very much in favor of capital punishment, simply because it imposes it so often. There are so many aveirot, there are so many sins for which there is capital punishment. Well, on one level, there are many, many aveirot for which there is the ultimate punishment. And yet, if one studies the Talmud, one studies the Mishnah and the Talmud, and one sees the procedural requirements that are necessary before capital punishment could be imposed, one would see, as the Talmud indeed concludes, that if the death sentence was imposed once in every 7 years, and according to another opinion, once every 70 years, that was called a bloody court, because it was virtually impossible for it to ever happen. And indeed, the procedural requirements for the imposition of capital punishment in halakha far exceed what the ACLU would love the Supreme Court of the United States to impose. It is virtually almost impossible. Number one, first and foremost, the capital crime, whatever it might be, let it be murder, for example, must be witnessed by two eyewitnesses. They must see the actual act. Circumstantial evidence is generally going to be inadmissible. The classic example that the Talmud gives us is two witnesses see Reuven chasing after Shimon with a raised knife, and they see Reuven and Shimon entering a building, momentarily obscured from their view. When the witnesses come in, they see Reuven standing over Shimon with a knife, dripping with blood, or we would say the smoking gun. Obviously, Reuven was chasing Shimon. Shimon is dead. There is a knife that Reuven is holding, dripping with blood. Not enough. That is circumstantial evidence, because perhaps there was a scuffle, and perhaps Shimon wrested the knife from Reuven, and Reuven, etc., took the knife and killed Shimon in self-defense, so you can't tell. That is circumstantial evidence. So talk about O.J. Simpson getting off, again, under a purely Jewish criminal procedure. In all probability, O.J. would have gotten off, although there is some discussion regarding whether DNA would be considered halakhically circumstantial evidence, or perhaps it may have the level of eyewitnesses because of the extremely high probability. Number two, the witnesses have to be two in number. Number three, they have to be Jewish, at least in a Jewish criminal procedure. Number four, they have to be halakhically observant.
Well, again, halakhically observant Jews tend not to hang around the scenes of that many murders. They're not going to be in the bars and everything else. Number four, and I'll leave the issue of why this is so for another talk. They have to be men. Women in a purely halakhic court system are not admissible as witnesses. They have to be above bar mitzvah. Minors are not admissible. They have to be Shabbos observant. So we have to have the eyewitnesses. In addition, in order for the perpetrator to be sentenced to death, the perpetrator must be given a warning to cease and desist from his act before he commits it. And that warning must be acknowledged, for otherwise he could say, I didn't hear you. And that warning must be violated within a few seconds after the warning is given, for otherwise he could say, I don't have a good short-term memory, and I forgot it. So there's this requirement called hasra'ah. Otherwise the person does not get the death penalty.
Furthermore, the Beis Din, the Sanhedrin, which in capital crimes comprises a panel of 23 judges. Imagine that. There is no court in the United States that comprises 23 judges in a capital crime. But the witnesses are examined separately. And if there's any discrepancy in their story, even with regard to a minor detail, at least in a capital crime, that will invalidate their testimony. What color socks were the victim wearing? One witness says green, and the other witness says red. The testimony gets thrown out. Conversely, if the story is identical in terms of style, that gives rise to a suspicion of conspiracy and collusion. So you kind of can't win, because if it is exactly the same stylistically, that is a basis for invalidation. If there are discrepancies of detail, that is a basis for invalidation. I mean, you get the idea that the Beis Din essentially wants to invalidate
this possibility. So we have all of these requirements, evidentiary, severe evidentiary requirements for the imposition of a capital crime that renders it virtually impossible under a classic Jewish judicial system for capital punishments to be imposed. I should mention, too, that we do have some parallels to American constitutional rights. Although the Jewish law is not an adversarial system with attorneys and the like, but we know that the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution contains what is called a privilege against self-incrimination. That means no person can be compelled to testify against himself in a criminal case. Again, it should be very, very clear that if you're suing somebody for damages, you can be forced to testify as to what your version of the story is. This is an immunity. This is a privilege only against testifying in a criminal prosecution. Well, under the American Constitution, under American common law, it's very, very clear that although you have a privilege not to testify against yourself, confession is freely made, and if you are given your Miranda rights, right? Remember, you have the right to remain silent if you can't afford a lawyer, one will be given to you. So you have waived your Fifth Amendment privilege in a knowing and intelligent way. It's absolutely clear under American law, confessions are absolutely good evidence to establish a guilt. In some jurisdictions, you need a confession plus. So, for example, if I walk in and I confess to a murder and there's no body, that may be insufficient for a conviction, but certainly a confession is valid evidence in a criminal prosecution, provided it was not obtained in violation of a Fifth Amendment's constitutional privilege. In halakha, on the other hand, we have a very amazing statement that says, not only can you not be compelled to testify against yourself, but your confession is inadmissible as evidence of guilt. If you walk into the Beis Din, the court of 23, and you say, I did it, I murdered, at least under strict halakhic judicial procedure, the court will say, have a nice day, and go home. Confessions are inadmissible. Now, this is a fundamental distinction between what we would call civil and criminal law in halakha. And in civil matters, if I come in and I admit that I owe you $100, my admission is absolutely binding and I must pay it. If, however, I confess that I committed a crime, my admission would be inadmissible, as it were, to impose any type of criminal punishment, either death penalty or lashes or the like. Now, sometimes, in a given proceeding, there's a combination of criminal and civil elements. The example would be theft. The basic law of the Torah is, there is no jail, there's no imprisonment for theft per se, by and large, but if I come in and I say I stole $100 from you, so the civil liability is to make restitution of the $100, but in addition, there is a penalty, like a punitive damage point, in which you have to pay double. So if I stole $100, I gotta pay you $200. So the first $100 is restitutionary, it is compensation, and the second 100 is a penalty. But unlike the modern idea of a penalty, which would be payable to the government or to the state, the penalty is payable to the victim. That itself is very interesting because you can see that at least in terms of crimes against property, the Torah's primary concern is protection of the victim's rights, as opposed to simply enriching the coffers of Montgomery County or the state of Maryland or the like. Now, it turns out, therefore, if I come into a basement and I confess that I stole, so we actually split the sanctions. My admission is absolutely binding with respect to the compensation part, but my admission is inadmissible with respect to the criminal punishment. The net result is, if I admit that I stole $100, I have to pay you $100, but I don't have to pay the penalty of the extra $100. It is only if witnesses establish my guilt that I would have to pay both the $100 and the penalty. Again, this creates obviously an incentive for admission, which you might call plea bargaining almost, because it is to a person's advantage to come forward and admit, and indeed that could be part of why the Torah legislates it that way. But we do have, in one case, in other words, which contains both civil and criminal elements, the admission is binding for the civil element, and the admission is not binding for the criminal element. Now, this rule, Ein Adam Meisam Atzmo Rasha, which I'm also connecting to Motive Knas Pater, the concept that admissions are not binding for the imposition of criminal punishment, does perplex people. There's a question exactly what's the logic of it. Sometimes people erroneously say it's the same thing as the Fifth Amendment, but it is not. The Fifth Amendment gives you a privilege to be silent, but it does not preclude the admissibility of your confession, as Halakha does. So there are two rationales that are offered. Ultimately, we don't have a full rationale for this, but Maimonides offers a fascinating psychological rationale. Maimonides says there are many crazy people in the world who love to confess to all sorts of things they never did, because it will give them their, well, to use Andy Warhol's phrase, it'll give them their 15 minutes of fame. And therefore, Maimonides says, we don't allow the admissions in criminal cases because they are inherently unreliable. Now, that has actually been confirmed by any police departments. You will hear that whenever there's a serial murder going around, the police will literally get hundreds of calls from various people who are saying, I did it, I did it, I did it. People claim credit for it all the time, and the police already know, so yeah, this is the same guy that called about, you know, all the other ones, etc. So the concept that people are willing to admit, either because of depression, self-hatred, or a morbid desire for publicity, is something that has actually been confirmed. There is a second rationale that some modern writers have suggested, which is very, very interesting, because it has an echo in American law as well. You know that one of the most criticized rules in American criminal procedure is that which is called the exclusionary rule. The exclusionary rule says that if the police or law enforcement violated your constitutional rights by an illegal search or seizure, they searched your house, they searched your car, they found marijuana, etc., when they should have gotten a warrant, or they should have given you various warnings. So the exclusionary rule says not only have the police committed a no-no, as it were, that the evidence of guilt is totally inadmissible in the criminal proceeding, because it was tainted by a violation of constitutional rights. Now, that's been a principle that has been criticized by many people, going all the way back to Justice Benjamin Cardozo back in the 1920s, when he said, just because the constable blundered, should the criminal go free? You know, punish the policeman, whatever it is. But the argument in favor of the exclusionary rule is said to be prophylactic in nature, and that is to say that if you want to create a regimen which will totally discourage police misconduct, you have to have a rule that says when they engage in that misconduct, they will not be permitted to benefit from it. And at that point, the argument goes, there's much less reason for them to commit invalid or illegal searches and seizures, because the product of that illegal search or seizure will be inadmissible. In other words, it's said to be a prophylactic. Well, in this sense, the inadmissibility of confessions can also be an issue of prophylactic, because the point is, if you have a legal system that allows the admissibility of confessions, you are creating a situation where coercion is very much a possibility. Now, it's true that a coerced confession is inadmissible under American law, but coercion can take many, many forms. You can have the person who got his Miranda rights, who is sitting under a bright light for around 20 hours, and you have the policeman that has a constant tendency to tap, you know, his sidearm on the side there, or, you know, put the rubber truncheon or whatever it is on the table. And therefore, coercion can take many, many forms. And the genius of the halakha in a sociological sense is, by having a rule that even if you get the guy to admit, nothing happens, there's no point in trying to coerce him to admit, because it's going to be inadmissible. So, whether we regard this rule as the exclusion of confessions as going to their lack of reliability, or whether we regard it as a prophylactic attempt to ensure the integrity of law enforcement officers. It is a very notable rule of Jewish halakhic procedure that confessions are inadmissible on the criminal side of things. In addition, there are other technicalities in the Jewish capital case. You have 23 judges. Try to get 23 Jews to agree on anything. But you need a supermajority, not really, I mean, it's a majority of two. So, for example, 12 versus 11 would not be enough for conviction. You would need 13. Of course, 13 versus 10 is a majority of three. But theoretically, a majority of one is insufficient. There is also a rule akin to double jeopardy, which says that if the person was acquitted in the capital case, but there was newly discovered evidence that would suggest a reason for conviction, he cannot be retried, as opposed to the fact that if he was convicted and there's newly discovered evidence for acquittal, the conviction can be reversed. That would parallel, I would suggest, the double jeopardy rule. And then finally, there is a halacha that frankly is a mystery to many, many of the commentaries.
That says if you have a unanimous vote for conviction, there is some suspicion that the judicial proceeding is tainted, and therefore a unanimous
vote of guilty will actually result in innocence. So if it's 22-1, he can get killed. If it's 23-0, once
again, the person goes free. Again, that's one of the most inexplicable rules. But the point is, when you put all of this together, we have a system where, on one hand, the letter of the Torah seems to indicate capital punishment for many, many avodos, but the practice, as was exemplified by the rabbis of the Talmud in the Mishnah, is that capital punishment in practice could be very, very rarely imposed. In fact, the Gemara discusses that Rabbi Akiva, who lived after the destruction of the temple and after the power of capital punishment lapsed, Rabbi Akiva made the argument that if he would be on the Sanhedrin, nobody would ever be killed. He'd find a way to get everybody out. And the Gemara even gives some graphic examples. Rabbi Akiva says, in every murder case, the witnesses see the knife go through somebody's heart. Maybe there was a hole in the heart before the knife went in, and the person would die anyway.
How do you know? Adultery. Rape. What did the witnesses see? I don't want to elaborate on that in great detail. What did they see? Did they see the action itself? Or they saw something that looked like it, but they didn't see it. So Rabbi Akiva himself was in favor of an extreme view. Nobody would ever get killed.
And yet, one of the rabbis responded to him, Rabbi Akiva, with your attitude,
we'd have a lot of murders
going around, because there would be no deterrence at all. Again, it goes back to this old debate. Essentially,
again, there are many, many components to the issue of the morality of capital punishment.
Those who are in favor argue in part that it's a deterrence. Of course, people argue it's not a deterrent, but the reason it's not a deterrent is a circular argument in a way.
It's not a deterrent because it's very rarely imposed. That which almost never happens tends not to deter.
But it would be more frequently imposed. There would be a deterrent effect. Those who argue against it argue
that you're never really sure and you don't have 100% reliability. It's an irrevocable decision. Once it's done wrong, you can never undo it, and therefore one should avoid imposing it. So that type of argument is actually mirroring the Talmudic discussion where Rabbi Akiva says, you never know. And if you never know, you got to let the guy off. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, on the other hand, looks at the need for society to be protected, and he says you need some type of deterrent. So the point is this, without really fully resolving this issue, this is a striking example of the picture that is painted by the Koresh of the Chassad. The picture that is painted by the written law is a totally different picture than that which is painted by the oral law.
The written law seems to advocate execution of evildoers, people who commit these various sins. The oral law kind of almost read it out of existence in some way. Now you may say, well, so what sense does that ultimately make? What's the use of having a lot of sins which are demarcated capital crimes if the punishment is never needed at all? But there are a few answers to that. The truth of the matter is that since the Torah is a religious document, it is the word of God, it are the commandments of God, there is a point in terms of a moral pedagogical objectives. There is a point in demarcating certain sins as so nefarious that they are deserving of death, even if, as a practical matter, that death penalty is never going to be meted out, because it does serve the educational objective of giving a person a sense of how serious certain avodos are. In fact, this is an interesting point, which even has some secular analogs. And that is, the purpose of criminal sanctions, one of the purposes, at least a secondary purpose, is not exclusively to punish, but it's to express society's sense of outrage with certain behavior, which thereby sends a message to the citizenry and to the youth, etc., as to what is considered tolerable in our society and what is considered to be intolerable. This is very relevant when, for example, when you talk about proposals to legalize drug use or proposals to legalize legalize prostitution, gambling. So the argument is made, well, the police don't go around prosecuting adulterers anyway, so let's decriminalize adultery because nobody ever gets busted except in Arkansas, okay, for adultery or the like. So the thing is, but you see that philosophically there is an argument that if behavior is immoral, and you can debate this, but if behavior is immoral, there is something proper about criminalization, even if in fact the police are not involved in prosecuting, because it expresses a sense of outrage as to what is beyond the pale, what is not beyond the pale. Well, the Hapoel, similar argument is made with the capital punishment envisioned by the Torah, that even if it's not the punishment that anybody's going to get, but it gives a person a sense, a Jew, a sense of what is a serious thing, what is perhaps a less serious thing. And of course, on the other level too, if one is a religious person, if one believes in God, one recognizes there is no such thing, and this is a fundamental assumption of Jewish theology, there is no such thing of a criminal getting off scot-free. Because there is a God in the world, and the imperfections of human justice and the inability to establish guilt with requisite certainty does not mean the person gets off, but eventually the scales are going to be redressed. So, in a sense, kind of the hopelessness of how are these people ever going to get punished if the judicial procedure is so cumbersome and so exacting, the answer is a certain amount of justice in the world must be left for God to take care of, and ultimately that justice will be taken care of. So that's really one aspect of the problem. We've sketched out the Jewish criminal procedure in a capital case. Suffice it to say that this criminal procedure per se cannot be applied today even in the state of Israel. According to Halakha, the authority of a Jewish court to impose capital punishment for a variety of reasons lapsed with the destruction of the temple. The temple, the second temple, we just commemorated the ninth of Av. The second temple was destroyed in the year 68 or 70 of the Common Era. And in fact, we are told that the Jewish community stopped practicing capital punishment 40 years before that point, around the year 30 of the Common Era. And in fact, the Gemara has a drasha, the Gemara has a scriptural exegesis that makes the point that capital punishment is connected to the existence of a Beit HaMikdash. And there's another reason why we don't have that power today, and that is because in order for a judge to be qualified to impose these sentences, the judge must have what is called smicha, which is authentic ordination. Now here, I don't want to disqualify myself, but all rabbis in the world today are only ersatz rabbis. We don't really have real ordination. Rabbinic ordination is the unbroken line of transmission going from Moses onwards. And that line was broken sometime towards the end of the Second Temple period. And without that unbroken ordination, there is no qualification to impose those capital punishments. That's one side of the ledger. Well, clearly O.J., as I said before, would fare fairly well, probably, had he been tried before the Sanhedrin of 23. However, a point that people at the ACLU sometimes miss is sometimes you'll find people who try to draw on Jewish law to argue against capital punishment, etc., by showing the high level of evidence that is necessary, that's almost impossible to reach, is that Jewish law is not a monolithic system. And Jewish law has multiple judicial and administrative and executive tracks, each of which is governed by a different set of rules. Now, let's talk about this. It's one thing to say that Judaism has a procedure that it envisions in the Jewish courts, but Judaism envisions a system for non-Jews as well. And this gets us into a very interesting area of Noahide law. Now, of course, Jews are expected to keep 613 commandments of the Torah. God does not expect non-Jews to convert to Judaism, as you know, at least, well, some argue that historically this wasn't always the case, but at least for the past 1,500 years or so, Judaism has been against overt proselytization. I know that some of the denominations are trying to bring back that, but still, according to Halakha, proselytizing is something that is still considered to be a discouraged activity. So what does the Torah envision non-Jews doing? So the Torah envisions non-Jews obeying not the 613 commandments in the five books of Moses, but a basic code of humanity that is called the seven commandments of Noah. These are seven commandments that were given to Noah, who is the father of all humanity, after the flood. These include basic commandments like not killing, not stealing, ethical monotheism, not cutting off limbs of animals when they're alive, kind of an anti-cruelty to animals legislation. So theft, adultery, and incest, the basic crimes. Now, the Noahide code, actually it's very, very interesting. In this vision, the concept is, instead of viewing Judaism as a religion, it has been argued that essentially there is one world religion that God wants. That world religion is Noahidism, and the Jews are regarded as the priests of that Noahide religion. So just as within the Jewish people, the Kohanim have extra commandments within the framework of being Jewish, in effect, every Jew is a Kohen in the Noahide religion. Around 100 years ago, there was a Catholic priest in France who wanted to convert to Judaism, and he went to a rabbi, and the rabbi instructed him, instead of becoming Jewish, why don't you just explore the Noahide traditions and try to become a good Noahide? This person indeed became a Noahide. He wrote a book about called The Hidden Sanctuary, about the Noahide religion, and there is a resurgence even in the United States. In recent years, there are three or four books written by Noahide Christian converts, or converts from Christianity. In fact, the Wall Street Journal had an article a few years ago about a Baptist church in Texas that pulled down their crucifix, and they didn't become Jewish. They embraced Noahide religion. Now, the thing is that in an ideal sense, there would be non-Jewish rabbis who would be the halakhic scholars regarding the details of Noahide religion. Now, you might say, well, Noahide religion, only seven commandments. What's so complicated? Well, not necessarily the case. Don't steal. Right? A Noahide is enjoined not to steal. Well, is taking an excessive coffee break a form of theft? Is taking paper clips on? Is that theft? You have to ask a Shaila. You have to ask a rabbi. Who would the rabbi be? Ideally, it would be a non-Jewish expert in Noahide law. There aren't too many, because the Noahide laws are primarily discussed in Jewish Talmudic sources. So I know Rabbanim. I mean, I occasionally myself get some questions. I know that, for example, the Rosh Hashiva in Eretz Yisrael has a steady community of non-Jews who ply him with questions regarding the application of the seven commandments of Noah. I know a fellow in Chattanooga, Tennessee. On Shabbos, on Saturday, he has a Jewish congregation, and on Sunday, he ministers to the Gentiles. Now, we're not talking about Jews for Jesus here. We're talking about authentic Noahide worship. Same God, the God that gave the Jews 613, gave the Noahide 7, and he leads them in prayer, and he instructs them. So, what's interesting about Noahide procedure, though, is that in a strict sense, Noahide procedure is very, very onerous. Any violation of the seven commandments of Noah is a capital crime. That's an amazing thing. So it's not just murder or incest or adultery. Even theft, cutting a limb off an animal, is considered to be a violation of the Noahide Code that is punishable by death, at least under the strict eyes of Jewish law. Moreover, the judicial procedure in a Noahide court, which would of course would be comprised of non-Jews, does not have to follow Jewish procedure. Number one, you don't need two witnesses. All you need is one witness. And the witness can be obviously not Jewish. And men, women, children might be admissible. Number two, the Sefer HaChinuch, although this is an argument, says that in Noahide courts, confessions are admissible. That the rule against the admissibility of confessions applies only in Jewish judicial procedure and not in the Noahide courts. Number three, there are some opinions, not all, that say circumstantial evidence is admissible in a Noahide procedure as well. The point that I'm making is that O.J. Simpson might not be as lucky in a halakhic system as we might imagine,
because although the pristine procedure of the Sanhedrin makes it extremely hard to secure a conviction, that is not necessarily the same in Noahide courts, and therefore, ironically, Noahide courts are regarded as a parallel track which would govern the responsibilities and liabilities of non-Jews. So one has to be very, very careful that in many cases the appropriate comparison between Jewish law and secular law would not be comparing the Sanhedrin to secular law, but rather comparing the operation of the Noahide courts to the secular law, because the Noahide courts would be the courts that would actually be governing that situation, unless it arose in a Jewish state involving a Jewish defendant or the like. That's one point. There is yet a third track that needs to be kept in mind. And that is, you know, those of you who are attorneys,
who are at least constitutional scholars, or at least familiar with the U.S. Constitution, know that there are two types of courts that can exist under the federal Constitution as well. There are what are called Article III courts. Article III in the Constitution says that the judicial power of the United States is vested in the Supreme Court and in such inferior courts that Congress establishes. But then there's a concept that the executive or legislative branch of the United States can establish alternative bodies of adjudication to further executive or legislative aims. So, for example, the United States Tax Court, which adjudicates tax liability, is not a court under Article III of the Constitution, but it's an extension, as it were, of legislative authority. Well, we have the following concept. On one hand, the Torah envisions capital punishment and penal sanctions. On the other hand, the judicial procedure is so exacting and so cumbersome and so precise and so technical that the possibility of a conviction is virtually impossible. What is going to happen, therefore, if there is no fear of punishment and there is no fear of sanction, and as a result, crime is rampant and people murder with impunity and people commit other crimes of violence because they know they're not going to get punished? What's going to stop them? Now, as I said before, in an ultimate sense, God is going to stop them. But God sometimes does not act. It's an ultimate redress of the scales, so to speak. But that's not going to happen tomorrow. What's going to happen? How does society protect itself? So here, the Rambam articulates, this is all based on passages in the Gemara, the Rambam did not make it up, that there is an alternative track to the procedure of the Sanhedrin that is called Mishpat HaMelech, the king's justice. It is analogous on some level to what we might call martial law. Just as habeas corpus can be suspended in times of national emergency, there is a concept that the normal rules of evidence that govern procedures in capital crimes or any other criminal procedure may be suspended by the authorization of the king, at least on an ad hoc basis, when society needs that protection. Now, it doesn't mean the king himself has to sit in justice in every single case. The king normally will act through the court system, but the king, as it were, may authorize. Now, there's a lot that's unclear about how this works. I mean, Maimonides writes, for example, that the Mishpat HaMelech can involve a lot of things. Number one,
the Melech, I'll discuss what we mean by Melech. I mean, the Rambam is talking about the classical Jewish state that was a monarchy. I'll discuss how that would work in a society which is not organized under a monarchy system. But let's first deal with the pure monarchy. That the monarch, number one, has a legislative authority to promulgate laws to forbid X, Y, and Z, to forbid securities fraud or whatever it is. That's one aspect. Number two, he can suspend the rules of evidence, such as not requiring two witnesses, not requiring warning, not requiring eyewitness testimony. And number three, he can devise new and additional punishments beyond those that are written in the Torah. Again, I want to emphasize, these are three distinct aspects of the king's law. Number one, criminalization of new activities. In other words, a legislative power, as it were, to criminalize activities going beyond those that are found within the Torah's penal structure. That would be the authority to promulgate a prohibition against fraud in the sale of securities. Number two, a suspension of the evidence rules needed to establish guilt, such as circumstantial evidence. And number three, can devise new and additional punishments beyond those that are written in the Torah. Again, I want to emphasize, these are three distinct aspects of the king's law. Number one, criminalization of new activities. In other words, a legislative power, as it were, to criminalize activities going beyond those that are found within the Torah's penal structure. That would be the authority to promulgate a prohibition against fraud in the sale of securities. Number two, a suspension of the evidence rules needed to establish guilt, such as circumstantial evidence. And number three, creating punishments. For example, the Melech could proclaim that one goes to jail for 20 years for armed robbery, although as far as the Torah is concerned, armed robbery simply requires compensation plus a fine. There is no imprisonment. So you see, criminalization of new activities, suspension of rule of evidence, and the imposition of alternative and additional punishments, all of this is within the Mishpat HaMelech, the law of the king. Now, we know relatively little in halachic sources of the law of the king. It's a funny situation. In the Talmud, we have page after page after page describing the ideal judicial procedure, which never results in a conviction, essentially. And then we have kind of a footnote, oh yeah, by the way, all of this can be circumvented and changed via the notion of Mishpat HaMelech, the authority of the Melech. In point of fact, there is a lot of reason to suspect that for most of Jewish history, the Mishpat HaMelech was the norm, and the pristine procedure of the Sanhedrin was the ideal, which was almost never followed. In other words, that which is relegated to footnote status may in fact have been the norm. Now, but we know very little about it because the Talmud does not describe it. For example, when we talk about, the Rambam says, Sha'ashat Tzaricha Lechach, when the time requires such drastic action, are we talking about something that is proclaimed on a national basis? Or could this be local, you know, based on different localities? Are we talking about a proclamation that had to be made by a monarch? Or could it be made by the court individually? Are we talking about the great Sanhedrin doing it, the 71 Supreme Sanhedrin, or each court making its own decision? How long can a state of emergency last? You know that it's my understanding that the United States is still legally in various states of emergency dating from the Korean War. But because the Korean War was never officially ended, various emergency orders are still in effect. So all of this is kind of a mystery. Can the Mishpat HaMelech become the permanent procedure? Can a Melech say, because we live in such a decadent society, we are permanently on state of emergency with Mishpat HaMelech? What does that imply regarding the ideal system that the Torah envisions for judicial procedure? But be it as it may, it's very, very important to see, therefore, that on one hand, the Torah is extremely protective of the victim, not of, of the perpetrator, or at least of the alleged perpetrator, to try to establish innocence and the like, but there's always an out. The Mishpat HaMelech is the great flexibility that allows a society to respond to the dangers that it faces from criminals, whether it's violence to person or violence to property, both by a legislative grant to criminalize activity, a suspension of the rules of evidence, and the ability to impose sentences. But again, when is it invoked is not entirely clear. I will say one thing is very clear from Jewish history, that this authority of Mishpat HaMelech does not at all require a Beis HaMikdash, and it does not at all require official rabbinic ordination. In fact, it's a royal prerogative. And the proof of this is that for much of the Middle Ages, when Jewish communities were given judicial autonomy by secular society, in other words, in the Middle Ages, Jewish communities had prisons, they could punish, etc., we find a variety of punishments, including capital punishment, that were administered by Jewish communities. Some of the punishments might strike us as a little harsh. For example, in certain Arab Jewish communities, hands were cut off for theft, obviously borrowing on the sanctions that the Arabs themselves, that Islam itself imposed. Now obviously, the Torah does not envision loss of limb, and yet we find for these emergency powers, when it was necessary, when it was deemed necessary, these were emergency powers that were invoked. So that is a very fascinating book. I don't think it's ever been translated, but it's called Ha'onshin Achar Chasimat HaTalmud, The Imposition of... Imposition of punishment after the end of the Talmudic era. Because the typical yeshiva student, we are taught in yeshiva, for example, you know, after the Great Migdash, nothing. We don't do any of this stuff anymore. And yet we have a very, very deep history of punishments all the way until the Enlightenment, when, of course, in the aftermath of the French Revolution, Jewish communities lost their judicial autonomy. And of course, the modern state of Israel is not essentially halachic in terms of their criminal procedure, so that wouldn't be the same. But the halachic predicate of the state's authority to punish the crime is based on this notion of Mishpat HaMelech. Now, of course, it's interesting, we have two statements in the Gemara. One is the power of the Melech to punish violations of law, and the second is the power of the court system to suspend the rules and punish for violations of the law. And the commentaries point out these are two very distinct functions. The Melech's overriding obligation, even though the Melech could act through the court system, the Melech's overriding obligation is the preservation of order in society. And therefore the authority of Melech is limited to crimes against property and persons. It is not the Melech's function
to suspend halachic judicial procedure for ritual infractions. So, for example, a melech could not declare anybody who doesn't light Shabbos candles should be whipped 39 times, because that is not within the purview of melech. The Beis Din, however, the local rabbinical court system, however, had a similar power to suspend the normal halachot, even for ritual infractions. In fact, the Talmud records the story that we know that riding a horse on Shabbat, riding an animal, is not one of the 39 categories of work. It is not something for which one could be punished. It's only a rabbinic enactment. But the Talmud recalls that a court once was faced with a society in which desecration of Shabbat was rampant, and they declared that one riding the horse should be stoned. Now, that is a ritual infraction, and that is also a temporary emergency measure, but that is a temporary emergency measure that is the prerogative of the religious court, as opposed to the prerogative of the melech, of the king. Now, so in effect, what we've sketched out is, we have three distinct tracks of judicial procedure for the adjudication of wrongdoing. We have the ideal procedure of the Sanhedrin. We have the Noahide procedure that pertains to non-Jews. And then we have the ad hoc discretionary procedure of Mishpat HaMelech, which could result in additional criminalization and substitute punishments, as well as suspension of the rules of evidence. And the Melech's power was limited to that which affected the safety of society as a whole. So, to answer the simple question, would LJ have gotten off, is a much more complicated question than one would have assumed. If LJ would be Jewish and would have been adjudicated by the Sanhedrin, presumably he would have gotten off, although even then there is some question, well, if he wasn't warned, if he would have gotten off, there's some question whether DNA is as good as eyewitness testimony, but he still didn't have the warning, so he would have gotten off there. On the other hand, under Noahide law, many opinions do allow circumstantial evidence, and certainly in L.A. in the 20th century, there is ample cause for proclaiming it a dangerous place, which would result in Mishpat HaMelech superseding, as it were, the normal halachic requisites of criminal procedure. So, this is really the first part of my remarks. I guess I have to be a little more abbreviated, and that is to simply set up parallel columns in which you see that each procedure is very distinct. The question now I want to address, which is a more complicated one, is how does Judaism, or how does halakha regard as legitimate a system which does not comport with halakha internally? For example, let's take the non-Jewish system. Now, the non-Jewish system that we have is not exactly the Noahide system. In other words, they didn't consult the Shulchan Aruch or Maimonides as to how to set up a court system. But nevertheless, as you know, criminal convictions are commonly secured by confessions. They are commonly secured by circumstantial evidence. But that's okay, intrinsically, because Noahide courts are permitted to utilize circumstantial evidence and confessions. So, in a sense, the typical media for convicting criminals is not intrinsically a violation of halakha. It might be a violation of melacha, it might be a violation of Beis Din, Sanhedrin law, but it's not a violation of Noahide law. But the critical question therefore becomes, however, do Noahide courts have halakhic jurisdiction over Jews? In other words, are Jews supposed to be governed only by the Jewish court system? Or does halakha regard the authority of Noahides to extend even over Jews that are living within their jurisdiction? You see? Because the way it's of course, it's not that we have a choice. I cannot go to court and say, hey, I mean, also I want to be one of those militias out there in South Dakota, hey, I don't recognize the authority of the United States court system over me. That's not going to work, so, because they're not going to listen. But it is important in terms of, can I as a religious Jew prosecute fellow Jews? Can I as a religious Jew sit on a jury which may convict another Jew? Can I be a judge against another Jew? Even if we say that at best I'm functioning within the confines of the Noahide system. But does Halakha recognize that Noahide courts have authority over Jews? If they do not, then my participation in that system would taint me with the evil label of Moshe, turning people over for the legitimate government action. So here, there's a Gemara in government seer that one has to keep in mind. The Gemara recounts, this is on Pergimel, 83A, the Gemara talks about the great rabbi, Rabbi Elazar Ben Shimon, one of the great rabbis of the Talmud, who in his spare time became a policeman for the Roman government. There were a lot of thefts going on by Jews. Then, unfortunately, as you know, that the Chilul Hashem is a dispersion of God's name, and suffice it to say that sometimes we occasionally worry about this, even today, to our great shame. And he devised a way in which the Romans could apprehend Jewish thieves. He basically said, go into the bar at 9 o'clock in the morning, and anybody you see drinking must have been out the night before and stealing. Otherwise, he would be at work. There's some circumstantial evidence. Now, as you know from the New Testament itself, the punishment in Roman times for theft was crucifixion, was execution. That's exactly what happened. And as a result, therefore, imagine what the beloved Rav Shimon was doing. He was assisting the Romans in apprehending Jewish people who, even if they're guilty, are not guilty of a capital crime in the eyes of the Torah. And yet, he was assisting the Romans in their apprehension, resulting in the execution of people who are only guilty of a monetary crime. Clearly, this is not the same thing as a murder. These are people who were stealing. Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha met Rabbi Elazar ben Rav Shimon, and he said to him some very harsh words. He called him vinegar son of wine, because Rav Shimon ben Yochai, his father, was a great, great Sabbath. He said, you are vinegar, and your father was wine. Who gives you the right to deliver the nation of God to be slaughtered? And Rabbi Elazar ben Rav Shimon's response was, what I'm doing is, I'm taking the thorns out of God's vineyard. And Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha said to him, let God take care of the thorns. Let the owner of the vineyard take care of his garden. What are you doing getting Jews executed? Now, as is often the case, the Talmud itself does not systematically develop what this discussion is. But if you look in the commentators, there are basically two different approaches, and there are some very real ramifications for the issue that I'm raising right now. The Ritva, was one of the commentators who lived in the 1400s in Spain, says, what's Rav Elazar ben Rav Shimon doing? He says, Rav Elazar ben Rav Shimon is assisting the Roman government in enforcing their legitimate prerogatives as Mishpat HaMelech. The same way the Ritva says that a Jewish monarch has the right, when society is decadent and lawlessness is rampant, to criminalize and increase the punishment. Because that is a necessity of society, says the Ritva, non-Jewish societies have the same right. Again, meaning Halacha recognizes the authority of non-Jewish societies to do the same thing. In other words, theft is not a capital crime, but if a non-Jewish society wants to make it a capital crime because lawlessness is rampant, they have the halachic power to do so. And therefore, the Ritva concludes that the alleged Rav Shimon had the right to assist the Romans in carrying out their Mishpat HaMelech. Now, the question then becomes, yes, but that's what Rav Shimon. Rav Shimon ben Karcha said he was wrong. In other words, even if you accept the Ritva's explanation, that's the explanation of the guy who did it. But maybe, in final halakha, maybe the other person said, well, the Ritva concludes that the halakha is in accordance with
Rabbi Elazar Rav Shimon. So according to the Ritva, we see a very, very important principle. According to the Ritva's interpretation of that Gemara, it is not only permissible, but it's even laudatory for a Jew to assist in the prosecution of those who are violating the laws of the country in which the Jews live, provided that those laws themselves are just and fair. And that's a little complicated, meaning to say, obviously, if you'd have a government that criminalizes the practice of Judaism or something, there would be no mitzvah to aid and abet that. But if you're dealing with laws that involve theft, that involve fraud, that involve damage, that involve harm, even if the punishments are much greater, that's the point. The punishments are much, much greater than the Torah itself envisions. That is a legitimate exercise, the Ritva teaches us, of Mishpat HaMelech, and the Ritva understands that a Jew may exist in Mishpat HaMelech, even against other Jews, and even if the Melech is a non-Jewish origin. This is an application. We know, of course, generally, Dina B'Malchus Adina, the law of the state is binding on Jews. Jews must obey the law of the country that they live in. But we see something more from the Ritva. It's not merely an obligation to obey the law, but there is even a permissibility to participate in the prosecution and punishment of other people who break the law. And therefore that's called Nisir. For the same reason, Nisir meaning turning people over. For the same reason, and even more obviously so therefore, if someone is engaged in child abuse or sexual abuse or physical abuse or of that nature, to say that one cannot report it to the authorities because one is turning over somebody to a guy, etc., is totally erroneous, because the authorities certainly have a legitimate right under Mishpat HaMelech to prosecute that type of destructive behavior, and therefore it is incumbent upon me to assist them in eradicating that behavior. And that, in fact, the child abuse case is even more obvious, because there you're also dealing with potentially life-threatening behavior in which you're actually saving people's lives, and then for sure there would be a Mishpat HaMelech. That is the Mishpat approach. But let me just share with you another approach, because the richness of the Talmud is such that the same passage is susceptible to multiple interpretations. There is a much more narrow meaning of this whole story, which would not support these conclusions at all. And the narrow meaning simply learns this way. This is found in the various commentaries. The Romans had a policy called collective guilt. Collective guilt basically meant if we didn't get our quota of thieves, we would just wipe out the community. Meaning to say, as the Nazis, right, as was common in World War II, in concentration camps, if somebody was guilty of some minor infraction, if you didn't deliver them up, they would wipe everybody out. Now, according to Halakha, although generally you don't sacrifice one person for the benefit of somebody else, if somebody did something which endangers the life of a community, that person is classified as a yodei. Yodei is somebody who's trying to kill me, I can kill them first. And therefore, as tragic as it is, although the person didn't have the intention to endanger our lives, if I don't deliver the food, the entire community was in physical danger. And therefore, the Elazar Rav Shimon's dispensation to participate in prosecution was because of the principle of yodei, that in not delivering the perpetrator, the community would be killed. Well, obviously, if you understand that the dispensation of his participation was because of the limited rule of Rodei, that would have little or no application in contemporary American society. If I don't decide to become a prosecutor, I'm not going to cause the death of Jews by and large around. In other words, Yodek is a much more limited basis. The Ritva's understanding is that I as a Jew can legitimately participate in the non-Jewish exercise of the king's law. That's a very far-reaching proposition, and that's much different than saying I as a Jew can deliver somebody who poses a clear and present danger to the life of my community. That's a much more narrow proposition than otherwise. So, once again, it would seem, though, that the bulk of writing on this subject has gone with the Ritva's approach, therefore indeed it is committed for a Jew to be a prosecutor, to be on a jury, even to be a judge, even if it involves punishing Jewish people. Now, there are some complications, as you would expect. In fact, I'm aware of the case. This was the case in Muncie a few years ago, and I believe, based on this analysis, this was correct, where a man confessed, a religious, formerly religious, man confessed to his rabbi that he had murdered his wife. And the rabbi went and called the police, and the guy got arrested. And the person claimed in court that the rabbi divulging the confession was not admissible evidence because of the priest penitent privilege. What you tell a priest basically is confidential. And he lost because apparently he wasn't going to the rabbi to do tshuva. He was going to the rabbi asking him for some help and how to cover it up. I don't know why he thought the rabbi would help him. But the rabbi's position was, right, so then if you're planning on confessing anything, don't go to a rabbi, go to a priest. But the rabbi's position, I believe, was based solidly on this reform, that it is totally legitimate to assist the state in eradicating antisocial evil. And indeed, this case is much simpler. In the reform case, you have the scenario of a monetary crime being punished by death, which one could argue is not fair. Here, if you're in a murder in which the person is not going to get capital punishment, so I think it's a kal v'chomer, if for sure you are right, that would be a permissible thing to do. Now, this does not eliminate all complications here. It's simple enough to say, go ahead and do it, etc., because there are situations where what a person did, a crime that a person did, might actually be a mitzvah, according to halacha. And that gets more complicated. Let me give you an example, just to make a quick example. Let's assume, you know, we have various laws against blocking abortion clinics and the like. Now, Judaism does not regard, talk for another time, Judaism does not regard abortion as murder. It absolutely is not the same as murder. Until the child is born, that is not considered to be a human life. But nevertheless, it is a fair statement of traditional Judaism that Judaism regards abortion on demand as something wrong, unless there is some extenuating circumstance. Without getting into what that is, abortion on demand is not a proper thing. In fact, it's not only a violation of Jewish halakha, it's a violation of the Noahide code as well. Now, obviously, you could not kill a human being, kill an abortionist to prevent an abortion, because you can't kill a human being to prevent him from killing a fetus. That's not the law of Rodez. Rodez says that if you kill a human being, we will kill another human being. However, anything short of killing the abortionist would tend to be legitimate. I could kidnap, under halacha, I could kidnap the abortionist, if that would prevent the crime from being done. I could tie him up. I could block his way. That is legitimate, because if abortion is something that is, abortion on demand, I mean, is something that is wrong, anything short of murder, which would not be justified, again, that would not be permitted, but anything short of murder, one is permitted to do that. Now, we know that a number of these activities are criminal events. Right? There's legislation that criminalizes certain things. So that gets us into another aspect of the problem, and that is, it's one thing to say, I can prosecute people who committed wrongs that the Torah itself regards as wrong. Murder, theft, vandalism, even if the punishment is greater, even if the rules of evidence are not observed, that's mishpat hamelach. But what about prosecuting people for things which in the Jewish tradition are not only permissible, but would even be considered to be forms of mitzvah? That creates a much more complicated issue, and that may involve prohibitions of turning people over to Gentiles, meaning to say that where the so-called criminal act is something that halacha regards as a mitzvah, then indeed the mishpat hamelach may not be allowed to permit prosecution of that. But that's fairly rare. It's fairly rare. Most of the time, the act that the government will be punishing is an act that halacha regards as wrong, even if the rules of evidence are not going to be followed. Let me just end with one final point to come, again, just kind of thing I just want to stick on with, and that is, One major difference between Jewish law and secular law, which applies in both civil and criminal litigation, is the concept of confidentiality, and this is a fairly important rule. We know that there is, of course, what is called the attorney-client privilege, that communications made by a client to his attorney in the course of seeking legal representation are generally confidential. They cannot be divulged. They are normally inadmissible as evidence in a proceeding or the like. Under secular law, the same thing is, of course, true for a physician, patient, confidentiality, and the like. Now, it's important to know that under secular law, the requirements of confidentiality are very, very strict, and the exceptions are very narrow. There was a case in New York, probably maybe 12 years ago now, which involved a client, a person, who confessed to his attorney. There were two kids, children who were missing. And he confessed to the attorney that he had murdered them, and he directed the attorney to where the bodies could be found. Now, the attorney had a quandary because the parents did not know if their children were dead or alive. And the attorney obviously felt a very strong desire to at least inform the parents that the bodies could be found, to give them some type of emotional closure. On the other hand, if it comes from him, and he's the attorney of the person, that's very, very strong evidence of guilt right there. It would be a violation of confidentiality. Moreover, what he decided to do was, he made an anonymous phone call to the parents. He simply said, you can find your kid, they're buried at the bottom of this pit. Now, the truth of the matter is, that does not totally serve the client, so to speak. Because when they recover the body, there's a lot of forensic evidence they can get. In other words, even if they don't connect the attorney to the body, but once they have the body, you know, there could be fingerprints, DNA, hair samples, sperm, whatever it might be. If I recall, I don't recall how it ended, but I recall that somehow the word got out that it was this attorney that did it, and the New York State Bar initiated disbarment proceedings against this attorney for violating lawyer-client confidentiality. And it's really true. If your client comes in and tells you, I murdered 100 people, you cannot disclose that information. If he comes in and says, I will murder 100 people tomorrow, I will commit a future crime, then confidentiality is waived, and then you are supposed to disclose. But under the present formulation of the American Bar Association, the Model Rules of Professional Conduct, confidentiality is waived or is inapplicable only if the client gives you information that he is about imminently to commit a crime involving death or serious bodily injury. Meaning to say, if your client comes in and tells you, at least under the ABA rule, this is not universally adopted in every state, but under the ABA rule, if your client tells you, I am setting fire to my building tomorrow, 3 o'clock in the morning when nobody's around, in order that I should be able to collect $1 million in insurance, that is, under the ABA rule, that is a confidential communication, because that does not involve imminent bodily injury or death, that involves mere property damage. That is the formulation of the ABA rule. It's generated a lot of controversy, but it bends over backwards in the direction of great confidentiality. Jewish law, although it doesn't respect confidentiality, also recognizes that when third parties are going to be harmed, their interests must be protected, and Jewish law would advocate disclosure in many situations where the information would have to be confidential under state law, state or federal law. Patient tells doctor, I have AIDS, but I'm not going to tell about my sexual partners. Well, under many circumstances, that has to be confidential information legally, but absolutely Jewish law would require disclosure to third parties if this person is not going to take the initiative to do that. That does create a dilemma. Obviously, a Jew who believes in the Torah recognizes that their duties to God are paramount to their duties to man, and if the risk of disclosure would result in disbarment or professional discipline, so be it. That implies that may be a risk that a person has to do because we are human beings first conjurists first, and professionals second, and that is yet another, again, it's not particularly connected to this issue, but that's yet another important point of conflict that one must keep in mind, that where the secular system very much leans in the direction of confidentiality, Jewish law is probably more concerned with the protection of potential damage, even financial damage, to third parties and the like. So I hope that this at least elucidated some of the major controversies in the area. The bottom line is, if you are a DA or a prosecutor, go home, do your job well. And to quote Rav Shimon ben Yochai, to quote the letter of Rav Shimon, you are validly assisting HaKadosh Baruch Hu in getting the thorns out of the vineyard. The Yehoshua ben Korcha did not agree with that, but according to the Ritva, at least, the Jewish law is in fact in accord with the view of Rabbi Elazar ben Shimon. Thank you very much.
In secular law here, you have degrees of guilt, of first degree murder and second degree and so forth. When you talk about capital cases in the time of the Sanhedrin, with all of these qualifications, if it didn't all fit, the witnesses and so forth, they couldn't be found guilty of this capital crime. But did that necessarily have to mean that they went scot-free, they couldn't be lashed or in any way restrained or punished?
Yes, that's one of the actual questions. First, in Jewish law itself, we don't have two levels of murder, but we do have to deal with murder and manslaughter. Intentional homicide is a capital crime. Unintentional homicide has an institution of cities of refuge, which was death and exile. Now, you're raising the question, though, what if the person is brought up on charges of intentional homicide, but not necessary technicality? To justify the imposition of capital punishment. On one level, that falls between the cracks. The cities of refuge are not available for the intentional perpetrator, but death penalty can be needed out either. Now, my mind is right, and it's not clear what it's worth. My mind is right that the Sanhedrin is such an instance, without even involving the principle of matter, that is empowered to impose alternative sentences such as imprisonment, lashes, beating, and the like. Now, that's only unique that without hearing the comments you said, one could argue that that's just an extension of the lawyer office in the law, but he doesn't say it specifically. That's what we're doing right now.
My second question, which doesn't apply to Jewish law, but has confused me and you alluded to it, so I'd like to ask. In terms of confidentiality, where a patient, and I know this is a big issue, where a patient has AIDS and says he's not going to tell his sexual partner, he's threatening the life of other people. Why is that a matter that can remain confidential?
Well, other than his homosexual life in the United States, it's wrong. But you're correct. There is no intrinsic logic. We have many communicable diseases other than AIDS.
I know, but
the
risk
exposure is very much mandatory. You may not spill blood of a person within a prison. A dog beat out of the fetus. So that's actually how you get that.
Do you think this can deal with what the rules should be in the Jewish court to stop doing the Muslim? Or do they just simply leave that to the Jewish civil authority to adopt? And if so, how does the Jewish law ever countenance physical mutilation of
blocking
off
the
hand?
Well, again, as I said, the Talmud is very fragmentary. The Talmud is going to be recognized under the guise of the human suffering and the care of each other and their own loving. The ability to respond in whatever way they consider appropriate to break down the societal law and order. General grant, just like the Constitution gives general grant of power, and then the individual community have medical powers in ways that they regard as acceptable. So, the Talmud is concerned with that it's not set out in particular responses, it's simply contained with the grants which gave the community those particular stories. Now, this is related to something that we generally encourage, generally not. Once again, in various societies, in general, it was regarded as an appropriate space and the word patient was used in dialogue, but then again, most of the time.
The question of the king's justice, my understanding, that was used extremely sparingly in other extreme circumstances.
I don't have a clear answer.
could we go and
Okay, this is Michael McKenna, the friend. I'll be around afterwards if anyone wants to.